And yet, it hasn't been lost. We don't listen to the people that are telling us how.
As we look to the future and we see ourselves in kind of a transitional society, where do you think myth comes in a transitional society, which is kind of grasping at straws, as it were?
Well, myth comes in when you realize that the real judgment of life is not to be based on whether it's practical. The emphasis on practical, economic, and political ends leaves you without a ground, and the ground in the notion of what it is to be a decent and functioning and harmoniously put together human being. And it's that the myth has taught. I'm amazed reading some of these very, very, what we call primitive mythologies, at the sense of decency in the human being, in his relationship to other members of his community. Not the community outside, but his community.
Going back to that brotherhood, the idea of brotherhood, I think of the American Indian when they had no concept of owning land. And it took the white man to come in and say, this is my land and it's not your land. And there were so many traditions that we just sort of, that we came in and just sort of covered over and just destroyed with our perception of the way things work.
Well, the most vivid contrast comes, and I heard this only last week, actually, this speech that Chief Seattle delivered when white men wanted to purchase his land. He said, how can you purchase what we don't own? Our brother Eagle, will you take care of him? The water, my father's blood, my father's voice is there. And this land, and that impresses me so. Here are people that had tough lives. I mean, it was real tough, but they loved it. And here we are having it soft, and many of us just think, oh, gee, as James Joyce says, is life worth leaving? We haven't learned to live it. And that's because I think of this it, of the mechanical world round about. It's more difficult to think of this microphone before us as a loving thou than it is to think of a tree or a lovely little squirrel. And those people lived in a living world, and we're living in one that it's living on a very deep level. You know, the subatomic particles are there, too. But it doesn't look that way.
Yeah.
So we're disengaged.
One of the aspects of mythology that's always been fascinating to me is the vision quest. We can see it in almost every culture. Every tradition has as its base the vision quest. What is the vision quest?
That is the basic myth. It is the quest of anybody, for instance, in this world that we're in now, which seems to be disengaged from vision, is the quest for the visionary relationship to that world. That's they define a spiritual relationship to the world that you're in. As the world changes, the vision quest changes as well. Now, the first visions were those of the shamans in the caves, but their people were just very small groups compared with what is a people now. And when settled tribes, settled peoples began to be important in about the 10th and 9th millenniums B.C., the larger communities, the problem of relating to those comes up. And we have more complicated priestly relationships than in the earlier shamanic. And the shaman goes out and the priest comes in, who represents the gods of the community. The shaman's deities were his own private familiars whom he discovered in vision. The deities of a larger social group are inherited by the tribe. And the priest is the officer of those deities. He doesn't necessarily experience them as the shaman does. Now, that poetic experience is what we've got to have again. It's much easier to have a poetic experience in the beautiful mountains and forests of California than it is to have the poetic experience in the factories, let's say, of Detroit. But that's where it's got to go. And the vision quest to reactivate our world has to deal with our world.
Another aspect of the vision quest is the encounters with demons. And we have a tendency, I think, to push our demons under the rug and hope they'll go away, when in reality we really have to face them.
Our demons are our own limitations that shut us off from the realization of the ubiquity of the spirit. And so as each of these demons is conquered in a vision quest, the consciousness of the quester is enlarged and more of the world is encompassed. I mean, basically, that's what it is. It's getting past one's own limitations. These are within, and they seem to be without. Conflict between two people is the result of their respective limitations with respect to each other and so forth. And these are symbolized in these myths. So that the monsters and demons of mythology are really symbols of limitations within the individual. And in each age, the characteristic limitations change. As a people changes, its limitations change.
Joseph, it just occurs to me, going back again to the idea of how we really have to, we are a global society now, and the global myth is one that we really have to understand in a much larger way than we have up to now. And I think of that limitation, how we often perceive other cultures as being very different from ours, and how we somehow want to make them like ours, that American democracy, for an example, has to spread to this country and that country. And in many cases, the nature of the people and the nature of the situation is so very different that democracy in the form that we understand it could never work. And it's going, we have to really not only relate personally, but we have to take that personal understanding of our limitations to a global understanding, don't we?
Yes, I would say that's a major problem. A major problem is seeing in someone who lives a different kind of life than the one that you regard as the proper one, the human being at the same time. This whole thing of conflict and love, you know, where Jesus says, "I say love your enemies," he didn't say don't have enemies. You know, and you can become a slob on this thing and say, oh, everybody's just lovable, as though that person were not going to knock you in the eye. The problem of living as an aggressive, vital presence in the world and at the same time having this universal consciousness is a major one. I've been enormously impressed by, again, the primitive people who had to kill animals to live. But the attitude toward the animal was not of animosity. The attitude was of gratitude to the animal for yielding his body, you know, and playing the universal game where life lives on life. I mean, that's the way we live. We have been removed from this because our butchers do the butchering for us, and then we buy a nice, neat lamb chop, you know.
That's how we can come up with terms like megadeths, because we're so far removed from it.
Depersonalizing the object of being killed. But what is it when you do the killing yourself? These people kill the animals, and we're grateful to them for giving their body. Now, there's a very interesting saying from the Rig Veda. It's in a small verse in the 10th book of the Rig Veda that has been a clue to me for how this thing has to go. And it says, on the tree of our lives, that's your life, my life, or the world's life, there are two birds, fast friends. One eats the fruit of the tree, and the other, not eating, watches. Insofar as we're active in the world, we're the bird that eats the fruit. And what is the bird doing? It's killing the fruit. It's consuming the fruit. And the fruit is yielding to the bird, you know? The other, however, is indifferent to who wins. It's just watching this way of life. Now, in meditation, one can get so far onto the side of the bird that is watching that one can become unfriendly to the act of life. Do you see what I mean? And many people cut themselves off that way. Whereas the proper necessary attitude is to recognize the necessities of life, which have to do with competition, and affirm it, but not in the way of enemies, but in the way of participation in the game of being alive. Now, it's not too easy, but it's got to be done. One of the things that discredits the World Brotherhood point of view is the tendency to say, you know, turn the other cheek and let him smack you down. That's depressing of life. That's wasteland stuff again, because life is active and tensions are the very source of energy. But the attitude toward them is what's important.
What are some of the things that we might be able to do to bring us more in touch with that understanding of what we've been talking about?
Well, since people get their messages from the clergy, they really do. In this country, they do. I've been around now a good deal, and in the cities we may say, well, the source of people's virtue and all is from their intellectual life and their own personal living and thinking and the community of the people they're with. But when you get out of the big cities, we're still in the area where the clergy are the great teachers, and they're the ones. It's up to them. It really is. And this is why the Oriental gurus are having such a success, because the clergy, by and large, are hanging on to old traditions by main force. And they are exclusive traditions. They're traditions that say, this is the way good people are, that's to say, the way we are, and others are different. How difficult it has been to change the ideas toward, let's say, abortion, you know, in the face of rules from the past. The relationship of people to each other is changing and changing, and yet not being recognized.